Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, Denver, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Fichtor, Robert Tlise, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Chris F. Seeley, Professor of Philosophy at Fairfield University. Her book, Creolizing the Nation, is just out from Northwestern University Press. Can the concept of the nation be a resource for liberatory political struggle? Are the dangers of nationalism simply too great? In Creolizing the Nation, Chris Seeley argues that creolization offers theoretical resources for imagining the possibilities of decolonial nations. Such new imaginings are made possible by the ways creolization allows us to think subjectivity, community, and history inventively. Seeley draws our focus to everyday practices of sabotage and jostling as modes of creolization that deserve our attention. She creates conversations between the work of Edouard Glissant, Frantz Fanon, Gloria Anzaldúa, Maria Lugones, and Mariana Ortega, to theorize identity and community in terms of difference, flux, and ambiguity. Seeley gives us errant possibilities. Chris Seeley, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to talk with you this morning, and I want to hear about your background as a theorist and your interests and how you came to write this book, but we have some late breaking news about an award you were just honored with. So will you tell us about that?
Absolutely. And so, you know, late breaking indeed. I woke up on the morning of January 1st, 2022 with this news. So Creolizing the Nation was quite literally just awarded the Nicolas Cristobal Julien Batista Philosophical Literature Prize. It's one of the outstanding book awards that the CPA awards every year. So it's an honor that the book is receiving from the Caribbean Philosophical Association. And I couldn't be more thrilled because, you know, the CPA has been my intellectual community, and so many folks in the CPA have invested in me and poured into me as a scholar and as an academic. And it's an award that is over and beyond anything that I could have possibly, you know, dreamed of. So I'm very grateful.
Congratulations. I really understand why they gave this book that award. It makes a ton of sense. Yeah. Well, also tell us how you came to write this award-winning book.
Yeah. Right, I'm still getting used to that, but yeah, I can get used to that. So as you mentioned, I'll just kind of say a little bit more about myself and, you know, and the trajectory from, you know, my beginning until now. So I'm in the philosophy department currently at Fairfield University, which is in Connecticut. I've been there for about 15 years. And I joined Fairfield right after finishing up my graduate work at the University of Memphis. And so at Memphis, that at Memphis, I worked with Robert Bernasconi, who eventually ended up sharing my dissertation. And so Robert was pretty instrumental in helping me come to what ended up being that dissertation work on Emmanuel Levinas and Jean-Paul Sartre. So there's that. And then I should also say, before getting to Memphis, I was in college, and, you know, coming to Memphis and being in the U.S. in general as an international student, right? So I was born and sort of raised, came to adulthood in Trinidad. And I think that biographical bit about me is kind of significant when it comes to how I came to writing this book. Because a big part of my experience as an international student, right, and especially from a place like Trinidad, was that it sort of took me quite some time to figure out, I should say, how to navigate U.S. codes of racialization, right? And in the South, no doubt, right? So I went to Spelman College in Atlanta, and then I moved from Atlanta to Memphis, right, for my graduate work. So I say all of that to say that coming out of Memphis, having written this dissertation on Levinas and Sartre, was also very much alongside my still trying to figure out at that time what and who I was as an international woman of color in the U.S., right? And not feeling very confident at all in having any kind of chops to think through or talk about those questions in any meaningful or philosophical way, right? And so really what might seem to be a sharp turn in my trajectory, right, from writing a book. So my first book was on Sartre and Levinas, right? So from writing that book, which was really a book that dealt with questions of alterity, ethical responsibility, free subjectivity, to this book on a creolizing account of community formation and world making. It might seem like a sharp turn in my trajectory, but it really isn't quite that much of a shift. Because I think that the set of concerns that drove not only my first book on Levinas and Sartre, but also what drew me to Levinas in the first place, right? Concerns like the possibility of an ethical politics, the relationship between freedom and responsibility, the intersections between agency and vulnerability, and then the implications of our histories in who we are as subjects in the world. Those question sets are precisely what got me into the second book on creolizing the nation. So that's a short summary of how I went from there, roughly, 20 years ago to here.
And this book really takes on the nation, and it begins with this very discouraging tour of the concept of the nation.
Yes.
And it's great because you set it up, you make clear in the introduction that you're going somewhere liberatory and decolonial with the concept of the nation, but then you really mire us in the trouble of the nation. So will you talk a bit about that tour that we're probably more familiar with, and then how you move through that that troubling concept to open up possibilities with creolizing?
Right, sure, yeah. I love that question. So the ways in which I came to this book project is really via my interest in creolization, more so than my interest in nationness or nationhood, right? And so, you know, I came to creolization, again, to go back to my indebtedness to the CBA, you know, to really like working and thinking through so many exciting questions with folks in that community, right? So I came to creolization and I wanted to use it as a frame to try to foreground the kinds of politically salient work that happens at the level of everyday lives of these communities on the sort of receiving end of colonial power and domination, right? So using creolization as a frame to name sort of quotidian acts and decisions and gestures whose efficacy is not really about is about disrupting, and perhaps only in that moment, the habitus of power and domination, right? And coming up with new ways and more liberatory relationships to that power and domination in ways that shouldn't really be possible, right? So the title of the book, right, is Creolizing the Nation. And I think that at a first glance, readers might be somewhat disappointed that the book really isn't about attempts to salvage or redeem nationists, right? And so as an interesting side, I'll share this too, as an interesting side, there was an actual subtitle, right? As most books in our profession usually have, right? I had a subtitle because that's kind of what you do, right?
Yeah, I noticed. I kept looking for it. I was like,
I know. It's like, where's the long ass subtitle?
After the colon. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So yeah, so there was this subtitle floating around during the book's gestation stages, and that subtitle was A Poetics and Politics of Community Otherwise, right? And yeah, and so, you know, but in conversations with the folks at the press, with my amazing editor, Trevor Perry, who's just phenomenal, the decision was made to drop the subtitle for what you have now, which is, you know, a much less of a mouthful, right? But in any event, I bring that story up now to really stage what the book is trying to do, which is to say that it's not so much that nation, its interior logics, its rubrics for organizing life and economics and space and even time. It's not so much that the nation in itself can facilitate these sorts of liberatory projects that I just alluded to, but instead that these interior logics of coloniality and hierarchy, flattening of differences, that story, what I try to say in the book, that story doesn't give a complete account of what actually goes on in these nation spaces, because communities are always trying to configure these spaces differently, right? And trying to do so in ways that condition more human, more liberatory ways of being in the world, right? Creolization is a frame that I try to argue allows us to name such practices, right, that are oftentimes aesthetic, oftentimes cultural, or some space in between those two, right? But like you said, right, so the book starts off in chapter one by trying to lay out some key moments of, you know, what readers would probably know as the problematic logics of nationness, right? And so in that chapter, I summarize what in modes of national organization show up as the sort of metaphysics of the one, right? And there I'm really quite indebted to a book by Ricardo Sinan Restrepo, his book Decolonizing Democracy, which I believe came out in 2016, right? And so what that book shows is that under this metaphysics of the one, the particularities of our here and now are so often measured in these terms of static sort of platonic conceptions of truth, right? So there are either these perfect replicas or copies, or there's what fails to properly replicate the truth of this metaphysical oneness, right? And those failed replicas then in more standard nationalistic speech gets vilified, right? In the book, and we can get into the specifics of these terms later on, but in the book, and the way I turn to theorists like Edward Glissant, I juxtapose this way of organizing space and time with more rhizomatic conceptions of organizing space and time, so that the book really is moving between this dichotomy between root conceptions of community versus rhizomatic conceptions of community, right? And so to go back to chapter one, I give a synopsis about the linearity of national time and the singularity of national ground. And in both of these accounts, my aim is really to draw attention to the ways in which these narratives around legitimacy, right, legitimate belonging, fitting into a temporal story of belonging legitimately as opposed to blasphemously, are really central to modes of organization that are national in kind. And so root or stock, which emerges as though it's coming out of some unbroken linear line connecting some mythic past or history to the present. And then I bring in these more creolizing metaphors and conceptions to not only problematize that, but to say that dominant accounting of national space is really missing something significant and vital that's going on in that national space.
Yeah, and this is, you take us, one of the metaphors you use is about the way that the nation gets jostled. Right, like the creolization is a form of jostling, and so you take us into these histories and practices of creolization to look at what's happened, as you mentioned, to time and space in creolizing communities. To what's already, you give us this archive, right? You give us all of these both historical and contemporary practices, and so part of what you seem to be doing, I think, is trying to say, not only give that sort of the root narrative of the nation, but show how that's never been true. And so is that an apt way to think about the turn to creolization?
Right. Yeah. Yes, it actually is. Right. So not only, right. So never been true insofar as it's not the entirety of what happens. Right. And so if your commitment and your investment is, you know, giving an account or coming up with a theory or turning to a concept that can appropriately name, I think not ignoring not giving a name to these jostling practices is just quite simply not giving a full picture of what is happening,
yeah,
right?
It's bad conceptualization.
yes, exactly, right? And your tools, the conceptual tools that you turn to is really preventing you from seeing and naming what is there to be seen and named. Right. So very much yes to how you just conceptualize that. Right. So and so I should say too that the book doesn't detail this archive per se. Right. These practices of creolization as practices that both resist and refuse the totalizing narratives of domination. But it does try to work out a frame from which that archive, again, can be both read and understood. Right.
Yes.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so in this more creolizing account or narrating of the nation, my hope is to show that, right, that we might recall the ways in which these marginalized communities have always dreamed in blasphemies, right? So that's a phrase that I borrow from the scholar Micheline Crutchlow. And then to name that in particular as a mode of liberation politics, right? Dreaming and blasphemies.
Yeah.
And then secondly, this frame of creolization urges us to take that practice of dreaming and blasphemies into account as we think about not only possibilities for our future politics of liberation, but also, and this I think is kind of really key and central to what I try to do in the book, to also look at our present political landscape, right, as maybe already containing these spaces or liminal sites or wounds even, right, in which normativities of violence, like you said, are being jostled, being robbed of this, their so-called last word, right, and in ways that open up to something otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, and the person who helps you do, I think, a lot of thinking about this, and you've already mentioned him, is Glissant, and particularly images like the rhizome, the importance of opacity in his work. So will you take us through a bit about how about the resources that Glissant gives you theoretically for thinking
Creole? Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, my, again, discovery of Glissant as not only a thinker, but a thinker who's positioned really interestingly at this intersection of Caribbean philosophy or theory, and what, you know, folks in our profession would call continental philosophy or continental thinking, right? and he's been so helpful to me because he's allowed me to engage in the phenomenological method in ways that are particularly and uniquely attentive to the uniqueness of Caribbean geography or a global South geography more broadly, right? And this rhizome of the metaphor is really all wrapped up in that, right? So to say a bit more about this rhizome metaphor, and folks who would read the book would definitely be able to recall a thinker like Deleuze. But I should say here that you know, on my understanding, and many folks who use Glissant read him in this way, he's doing something with notions of the rhizome and rhizomaticity that are uniquely connected or uniquely primed for thinking through very geographically specific questions. So although there are connections to be made between what Glissant is doing and what someone like Deleuze is doing, I think it's most productive to read Glissant on his own terms, right? For those geographical purposes. So often to go back to this rhizome metaphor. So often in, you know, broad scholarship on creolization, right? So not only Glissant's work, but particularly Glissant's work. The metaphor of not only the rhizome, but the metaphor of the mangrove appears, right? And so my way of thinking through rhizome versus roots has used this imagery or this botanical metaphor, I should say, of the mangrove, quite centrally. And that's because the salience of the mangrove growth, right, is because it grows in this rhizomatic way, right? Its root growth is across and zigzagging, and it spreads wide instead of deep, right? So this wide and not deep figures quite centrally in what I mean and what the book means by creolizing the nation, right? But in any event, so what's salient about the mangrove is that a mangrove growth is what happens or what grows in swampy water, right? So you have this meeting or this intersection of fresh water into but fresh water that the salt of the sea is entering or bleeding into, right? So it's a swampy water. And so what I try to sort of play around with is that if we could maybe articulate a kind of politics of the mangrove, right, we would say that firstly, there's this emergence and enactment of life out of something that shouldn't really be able to support life, right? So the brine and the salt of the swamp. And then secondly, as this mangrove is sort of making life happen out of this particular not conducive to life ground, what it's doing, and perhaps quite inadvertently, one might say, what it's doing is it's stopping erosion. It's actually affecting the landscape and the architecture of that landscape, right? So it's making that landscape, it's transforming it into something that must now reckon with the life-generating work of this mangrove. And so the landscape, you know, in this particular metaphor in my head, the landscape is the nation and its architecture. And so the zigzaggy rhizome roots of the mangrove is, to my mind, a metaphor for these liminal practices of freedom that make life out of brine, make a way where no way should really be possible, that creolization tries to theorize. And so what I want to say is that what I want to offer is not some sort of saving narrative of nationness, but to say that there is something always already happening in within the space of what looks like at face value simply and solely violating or violent logics of nationness, but there's something happening that the nation must reckon with.
Right. Yeah. The mangrove.
Yeah.
Grows. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and then so you connect to this other body of work in Latina feminism, and it especially given what you just said, it makes so much sense when you do it in the book. But as you also point out, it's not often done, right? This connection between these literatures is not often done. And so you turn to people like Lugones and Anzaldúa and Ortega, especially to think through subjectivity in this project, to think about difference and coherence, ambiguity and homemaking. So tell us about bridging these literatures, and especially about how it helps you think about history and nature.
Yes. So it was right. So, I mean, I would say, and this could just simply be particular to my process and and the way I think about things. So often I kind of get clarity on the questions that's mulling around in my head by the pure accident of what happens to be on my desk together at the same point in time, right? And so, I mean, I wish I had like a more profound accounting of how I came into this intersection, but it just so happened, right? So I'm a huge fan of Mariana Ortega's work. I'm not just Mariana's work, but who Mariana is as a person. So you know, I was reading through her work when it came out, and and her book was really kind of leading me into these various avenues. So I was thinking through Lugones and Gloria Anzaldúa, but at the same time, reading, Guisan's Poetics of Relation and reading Guisan's Caribbean Discourse. And so when this book came into focus, these connections were like super obvious to me. And so my plans for the book was to just present the archive of thinkers who were thinking through these intersections, and came to find out there was not really anyone thinking through these intersections. Guisan's was not talking about Anzaldúa. I found one article by Lugones where she like footnoted Guisan's in this piece. I can't remember the name of the article or when it came out, and that was it. And I was like, I was shocked. And just kind of moved, because the connections in my mind, like the ways that these two bodies of work was thinking through these questions of homemaking and ambiguity and subject formation, just seemed really primed to speak to each other. And so that's kind of how Chapter 4 came to be a part of this project. So, for anyone out there who feels as though they're groping in the dark, there is value to that. So just hang tight is what I would say. it's unnerving, but you know, it works out sometimes in some interesting ways. But anyway,
it really bore fruit. Yeah, for your project, totally.
Yeah, no, I was happy. I was happy the way in which this intersection really opened up the book. Right. So on, you know, in the book and on my reading, these thinkers like Anzaldúa and Lugones and Ortega are really also grappling with these questions of belonging, identity making, that has to be that so often begins in a kind of historical fragmentation, right, or liminality, right, or you know, to paraphrase from Ortega's work, from this kind of in-betweenness, right? And so what really drew me to this, you know, to bringing together these constellations of thinkers, is that they all seem to give us language, metaphors, concepts to understand how communities that are shaped in conquest and colonial violence live their lives in ways that are never entirely determined by that historical violence. And that to me is being able to name that and think through that has so many significant implications, not just in terms of theory, but in terms of activism and praxis, right? Because we have this really robust accounting of what historical violence is. And I always feel like more can be said about the inventive and liberatory ways that folks shaped in conquest figure out how to live lives that are never entirely determined by that conquest, right? And so that's really what the book tries to do. And so that way of being in relationship to history without being entirely determined by that history is precisely what Glissant's story about Caribbean creolization is all about. And so I try to show in this chapter, I believe it's chapter 4, I try to show how concepts like Lugones's playful wool traveling and curdling, how Ortega's account of a multiplicitous South is really giving us a very similar story, right? Or attempting to grapple with how we might understand ourselves as coming out of a particular history without never entirely being of that history in this sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just as you said, it's not just theoretically, but practically a really exciting chapter in how it brings together possibility, sometimes out of what seems like, you know, historical forces that are just shutting down all possibility.
Absolutely. Right. And that way of totalizing, of accounting for those historical forces as totalizing is really key, right? Because I think without understanding the pervasiveness of it is to not understand in a full productive way what we're up against, right? But that accounting of pervasiveness, to my mind, should never be at the price of undercounting or undernaming all these other things that are happening at the same time.
Yeah, and this is, I see you make this move in the book a few times, such as with the concept of the nation or with this history of violence, that you really give a full account of you don't soft sell the violence or the totalizing nature of the concept of the nation, right? But then you give us more by moving through that.
Yes, exactly. It's a sort of, you know, and I mean, I would say this, right? So, I mean, this is always a line that I try to establish, when I teach classes about these sorts of issues and work through these sorts of texts. And very often I find that, you know, how you get to that line, how you maneuver into that line is very dependent on who your audience is or who the folks are in the room, right? And so, you know, some audiences are really primed to want to hear that, you know, colonial violence and domination really isn't that bad, because look at all of the amazing things, right? Look at all the amazing things that the Global South and folks of color have been able to do. Look, they made the blues and they made hip hop, and it's so wonderful, right? But right, and so I, in the book, I try to present the book as a text that is not meant to convince that kind of audience or to convince that kind of readership of how awful colonial domination is, right, and its attending violences, but to say that, yes, we get it. This is a historical force that perhaps humanity has never seen in the history of humaning, right? We get that. But what are some of the other things that needs to be foregrounded, given how clear it is that colonial violence is as awful as it is?
Well, and so given that, especially, it's not surprising you do take us to Fanon in the book. And it makes, I wrote down your subtitle, Poetics and Politics of Community Otherwise. Was that? Yeah. So if Glissant is on the poetic side, right, then Latina feminisms and then really Fanon gives us the politics, right? You're bringing us through.
Absolutely.
And there's a connect, right? Like what this allows you to do, the way you develop it allows you to show the interrelationship of the poetics and the politics.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk about nationalism for Fanon and what work that allows you to do.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, this was also another sort of natural point of connection, you know, for me as I was working through the book. And I know that there is indeed lots of good work out there that brings together what Glissant is doing in the, like you said, poetic register, alongside what Fanon is doing in the more overtly sort of anti-colonial revolutionary political gestures. So I really see the chapters in the book that talk about Fanon as entering into an already quite robust conversation. Right. And so the reading of Fanon that I offer, and this is towards the end of the book, the last chapter of the book, tries to center what, to my understanding, are really possibilities of thinking about fluid negotiations with the past, very much like what we find in the kind of temporal bricolage is a term and a concept that floats around in Creolization literature quite a lot, right? So the idea of the past coming into the present to generate something for the future that is otherwise than the changing theme of the past, of past violence, right? And so all that to say, reading Fanon in a way that is able to show how the past and potentially the future is not quite overdetermined by that. How the present and the future, is not entirely overdetermined by the past, right? So a lot of this is really thanks to, you know, really formative conversations that I had with Jane Gordon, right? Again, someone who is part of that CPE community. And I have lots of thanks to give to her while working on this project. She's really open to having these conversations with me. But this one in particular, right? So in this chapter, I use the story that Fanon gives us about the transistor radio, right? The transformations of its cultural and political meanings at that historical moment in Algeria as they were coming into the Algerian Revolution, right? In their fight for independence against France. Right, so I use that as an example that comes directly from Fanon to give a concrete shape to what I mean by these fluid negotiations with the past and fluid negotiations with power. Right, so my turn to Fanon in that chapter is perhaps to say something like this: Fanon's anti-colonial revolutionary politics could be read. Or could be understood as a political modality of Glissant's more poetic articulations of compositeness and rhizomaticity and errantry, right? So in other words, a turn to Fanon, or my turn to Fanon, I should say, is to say that a Fanonian politics of decolonization would have, at the level of the everyday, these transformative processes, right? The radio, the transistor radio, for instance, moving from a sign of French colonial domination in the home to the radio being a sign of solidarity with the Algerian revolutionary fight for sovereignty, right? Right. So these transformative processes are processes that are not unlike what in both Guisan's and theories of creolization more broadly name as these creolizing adaptations, right, which offer more liberatory relationships to power without necessarily toppling or undermining that power, but figures out a way to be in a more liberatory relationship with it, right? So all of this isn't to say that everyone can locate these creolizing adaptations, or one can let me say this differently. What I'm not saying is that, you know, everywhere you find these creolizing adaptations, you can expect something like a Fanonian anti-colonial revolution, right? That's not what I'm saying, and that's not what the book is saying. But the book does want to say, as a matter of cultural and poetic sets of inventive practices, these on the ground working out of different ways of relationship to power is not only sort of key for conditions of possibilities of this colonial otherwise that Fanon imagines, but more importantly, that we can use creolization to name these different ways of relating to power, right? And so my turn to Fanon towards the end of the book is in the spirit of it is in the spirit of at least beginning a conversation at the intersection of a cultural politics or a poetics and politics, sort of big upper P politics, you know, in a more explicit sense.
Yeah, that's so helpful, and gives us a way of thinking about, again, at the theoretical level, but also in lived experience of the everyday, right? Like how things could hang together.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's so often the case that, you know, these things that are happening to us or through us or with us at the level of the everyday, it's so easy to lose sight of the liberatory implications of those. Right. And because they're not big and their gestures aren't like fancy or sexy, but they're all meaningful. And I think you couldn't really make sense of those more big, fancy, explosive political moments without paying attention to all these things at the level of the everyday that had to have happened and continues to happen to make those more bigger picture moments possible.
Well, and so your conclusion is titled "Creolizing is an Imperative," and here you anticipate that you're going to make this move in the introduction, but this is where you really begin to have a conversation with Indigenous scholars, and especially Judy Bird and Glenn Coulthard. And so why imperative, right? Like what's imperative about what's happening here in this move from what you've been doing in the book to connect it to Indigenous, theory and activism and scholarship?
I really appreciate that question. Because I think how I end the book is more valuable to me than probably any other part of the book. It's like, oh, this is not done. This is just beginning.
No, this is where I am now. Yeah, this is all done and finished.
Exactly. This is just kind of like working out the kinks and setting up the frames. So here the work now begins is really how I think about towards the very, very end of the book. Fanon's critique of what he understood as a kind of ultra nationalism might be a good entry point into this question. So I end the book with this turn of phrase, right, creolizing as an imperative, really as a way to keep thinking about creolization as what's always giving the communities the capacity to orient themselves in these unexpected ways, right? Specifically, ways that don't reproduce systems of violence, but rather gesture towards some other possibilities or some other kind of world making or being with each other, right? And so by the book's end, I try to make it clear that these possibilities towards which creolizing imaginaries can lead us are to be read at just that, right? In the register of possibilities, right? The political effects of which are not, it's not really about offering clearly delineated structures or codes, but instead, right, how these imaginaries contest with the very telos of existing power, right? And so what emerges through this undoing of power's claim to legitimacy is an otherwise that we can think of as maybe opaquely so, like opaquely otherwise, right? So radically outside the frame that power is giving us, and that is being contested at the same time, right? So I would say that what I've offered as a properly creolizing account of the nation is an attempt to center this imaginary or this politics as something that is in order for it to be sufficiently otherwise, so as to orient the nation in this particular way towards a future that has not yet to come, right? And I want to say that out of this kind of reframing, something like closure, or a clearly delineated end, right, towards which we're going, closure would show up as premature, and stasis would show up as a kind of failure, right, to do what what Amy Allen urges in her book, which is really what prompted this. Amy Allen's book is really what gave me the language to say what I wanted to say in this sense. So stasis would show up as a kind of failure to not do what Amy Allen's book says, which is to enact this project of decoupling progress as an imperative from progress as a fact. Right, and that's a paraphrase from Amy Allen's book, and so in that spirit, what that has brought me to at this point, right, towards the end of the book, and this is sort of where I am right now, is to think about creolization. I really want to think about creolization in this way, given what I saw as I was bringing the book to an end, and I continue to see, is in this possible encounter between creolizing communities, right? So folks that are that emerge in these experiences of diaspora, transplantation, movement, an encounter between those sorts of creolizing communities and indigenous communities, right? Communities that really have a very different relationship to land and landedness, and who actually also figure in the story of colonial conquest, but figure so in a way that's very different, right, from creolizing, from creolizing identities. And so it's really with these sets of questions that I conclude the book, and I sort of on purpose, lay out these questions in order to signal a kind of incompleteness in the project. And by turning towards questions and problem spaces that, creolization generates, but might ask us to go beyond the frame of creolization itself, to think more productively about. So that's kind of why I felt compelled to sort of end the book with not a closing, but an opening and an invitation.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so true to your concept of creolizing,
Right, yeah, like, I know. Yeah,
it doesn't
exactly set
up the metaphysics of the one.
No, it does not. It's not comfortable. It's very uncomfortable.
Right. That's a good word, because it's not pat, right? It's not like, right, and that's the end. Yeah.
Exactly. And in this sense, I think, if I could say this way, I think that, my Levinassian underwear is still showing, right? So this idea of like, you know, it's not about like, oh, okay, we have like an ethics now and we can move on to something else. Like
right.
it is meant to end sort of uncomfortably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what are you working on now?
Yeah. So, right. To go back to the uncomfortableness. So I have, I can describe it. I have these two sort of separate projects going on right now, but I think they all, you know, as I work through them, I think I could see them pointing to one common space, right? In other words, two streams that could really end up being part of a larger single project. So the first one is really about these preliminary questions around creolization and indigeneity. And so I have that in paper form right now, and I'm trying to pursue these two questions, right? So the first question, how to think about the often unavoidable anti-Blackness with which decolonization pursues indigenous restoration and land repatriation. And then two, the often unavoidable settler logics within which a politics of Black abolition can pursue the possibility of thinking Black and free together, right? And so I at least for now, you know, I'm continuing to use Edward Glissant's conceptions of opacities in relation to argue that opacity is a frame that we could use to sort of center these two sets of questions, you know, and to understand what happens when it comes to when we try to do decolonizing and abolitionist work together. So that's the sort of first project. And, you know, as you could probably tell, it's very much an inheritance of where the book ended, right? Yeah. And then the second project, which could definitely connect to this first one. I'm currently thinking through questions of living Blackness, Black resistance, and practices of freedom, just very broadly in a context of anti-Black violence, right? And so as a theory, creolization, at least so far, allowed me to frame such questions in the context of Black life worlds in the Americas, right? Who, you know, where the starting point, the sort of quote unquote starting point, as it were, is, you know, the radical rupture of the experience of the Middle Passage. And so in this last book, you know, the thinking through those questions were really curtailed or framed specifically in the context of the nation, right? But this sort of newer emerging project, I think, wants to move beyond the boundaries of the nation question, right? And perhaps also beyond, you know, the grounding that creolization can offer as a concept, right? To think through, you know, more general questions of how we can name practices of freedom that unfold, that can unfold against the context of unfreedom, right? And so I'm thinking through what Octavia Butler does in her work. I'm turning to Achille Mbembe's work, Catherine McKittrick, Alexandra Mohaley, Tiffany King. So I'm super excited about this, about where this might take me. So yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see these projects. This is great.
I appreciate that. Me neither. I can't wait. I'll let you know how it goes.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Chris Seeley, for this wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. And thank you for inviting me, and just in general for, you know, the work that you're doing, Sarah. Like, these conversations are, I think, super important to our community. And I, for one, thoroughly enjoy the podcast. So I appreciate
it. Oh, thanks so much. Well, this, I have to admit, it's been a hard pandemic, but getting to have these conversations has really kept me going.
Right. So, I know. Yeah. I know. Indeed.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.